Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Scott Silsby's Handprints in a French Cave, and it's about poems and French cave paintings, but more on that later. I'll explain the reference at some point. Or this is one of the podcasts where I just don't do that, and I run out and I post it online, and people are just going to have to watch that Werner Herzog movie. And so our guest is probably somebody who knows something about Scott Silsby's handprints. Mr. Scott Silsby, thank you for doing this, being this. Say something for yourself. Introduce yourselves to the fine men and women of cyberspace.
Hi, men and women of cyberspace. This is Scott Silsby. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so you're a poet, and okay, I'll say the reference and why it made me think, because I spent the weekend and yesterday prepping for this with your two fine collections of poetry, The River Underneath the City, buy them now, and Unattended Fire, buy that too. And the thing that I found, like, really sort of, you know, the thing about this podcast is, so I find things that I like about what people do, and then I sort of talk about that thing. And what I really like about your poetry is how, you know, you find depth and meaning in these kind of nonsense moments in life, or these sort of, you know, these moments, you know, I hate to, you know, use the John Lennon thing, you know, life is what happens while you're busy making plans. But, you know, these moments of life that I think the way my mind works,
yeah,
you know, is these things stick for some reason. Uh-huh. And so the big thing I want to talk about with you is how, you know, in terms of your process and sort of finding the meaning of these moments and not letting them go. And it comes down to the handprints on the cave paintings because, you know, yeah, there's that cave in France that has paintings from, you know, they say 30,000 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And there's a series, if you want to call it a series of paintings, of, you know, just people's handprints. You know, and I think about that as, you know, is that the first piece of art? And you think, you know, that handprint is, I was here, I am somebody.
Right.
You know, yep. And I think about how the sum total, you know, reading these collections, and I sort of, you know, I tend to like to read collections of poetry like a box of chocolates. I sometimes don't even pay attention to the sequencing. I think there's some care that goes, I'm like, oh, fuck it.
Right.
You know, I'm just going to, yeah, this one in the back looks good.
Yeah.
But I did, so I binge read, and thinking about, like, the sort of the sum total of your poetics and how, yeah, I mean, finding meaning in these moments and sort of capturing memory and how, you know, it's finding worth and value in that. And we live in this cultural moment where, you know, we only have superhero movies. So what are you going to do? You know? And so I find that nicely refreshing.
Cool. Yeah. Well, it's definitely something. Yeah. It's definitely something I think about, with my writing. I think of my writing as kind of a documentation, keeping track of stuff, so I don't lose it. I carry a notepad around with me, you know.
Oh, really?
And it helps me to keep track of things that happen.
And so for you, is the process of writing a process of, like, figuring out the meaning of that? Is there, like, when you... Because I'm thinking about some of these moments in these poems, and I'm just going to pick one.
Okay.
If I can pick one, can I pick
sure.
one?
Yeah, sure.
Which one is it? It's while he's driving Unattended Fire, which uh-huh. is the yellow tag. I did my homework, people.
Uh-huh.
I put little tags. It's page 24 of Unattended Fire. You can buy this from Six Gallery Press. I'll have the link on the website. Would you mind?
Yeah, no.
Imposing on you to read this?
No, yes. No, I don't mind at all.
Sorry, I feel like a monster sometimes. Like, I have a podcast, you have to do what I want. You know?
Taskmaster.
Yes, I am.
Sure, I'll read it. As he's driving, my friend yells, "Love fades," out his window at a couple walking hand in hand.
Great. I mean, I laughed out loud, you know, when I read that. And I wonder if for you, is it like, is there like a moment of cognitive dissonance? That like this thing about this person just kind of sticks in your head, or this imagination. I mean, was that a real thing? Is there a real person?
I think it was kind of loosely based on something that happened. Yeah, a lot of times I feel like the things that like I write down in my notepad that I carry around, it's like something that strikes me as funny or just weird. A lot of times weird things like just like, you know, jump out at me.
Yeah.
So it's those moments when life just kind of jumps out.
Yeah. So is the process of writing then trying to put it in, I want to call it like maybe symbolic order or discovering the mystery of it? Like, it depends. So the symbolic order, so you're Jacques Lacan and this is like psychological trauma or whatever, and you're just trying to find meaning so you can maybe cycle it through your brain. Or we can be Joseph Campbell and be like, well, what is the mystical, you know, of it? But finding out the mystery of that moment and thinking like, what did that mean to me or whatever? Like, how does that work in terms of your process and how maybe your thinking about these events changes,
you know,
when it becomes a poem?
Right, right. Well, so there's the initial, like, note-taking, but then there's the, like, revisiting the note and, like, making something out of it, making a poem out of it.
Yeah.
And so it's an editorial process, like, you know, but
yeah.
I think of it as kind of like making kind of an order out of the chaos of everything that goes on,
yeah.
And just finding these things that are important for, you know, for one reason or another. It's kind of documentation, but then there's also interpretation, you know, like,
yeah,
figuring out, yeah, what is it, if there is some kind of meaning to it, or if it's just something that happened.
Yeah, and so then too, is it a question of, for you, documentation, do you feel any, you know, because I'm thinking there is a, maybe, there might be two different poetic concerns, right? Is one just being a good poem and that sort of aesthetic thing. And the other one is, like, but that's not what really happened. Like, is it, you know, thinking about, you know, this sort of Jack Kerouac thing of recording Angel, like, I must remember every detail or something like that. So in terms of you thinking about, like, cycling through these memories and these moments, thinking, you know, is there a moment as you're writing, thinking, am I really capturing everything that happened? And is that okay? Because I think about, because I dabble in poetry, and it's the same thing that I do. It's like, yeah, but I was having this other thought. It completely destroys the poem, but it's got to be in there somehow. And that's why my poems are awful, right? So, but yours are good, so how do you make that work?
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't feel like I have to have, like, a fidelity to, like, things as, you know, capturing things as they actually happen. I find that I want to, like, create the best poem that I can.
Best poem.
Yeah.
So I guess, well, I guess then too, there is, I remember, you know, doing research in, like, the Quentin Tarantino, like, recent films, you know, Inglourious Basterds and Django Unchained.
Uh-huh.
And I found this great piece where somebody was talking about there are things that are factually correct.
Uh-huh.
And then there are things that are emotionally correct.
Right.
You know, which I think for those films, right, he totally, I mean, not that actually, I mean, there was a, you know, a legit underground Jewish resistance movement that doesn't get talked about in history, which wasn't quite like Inglourious Basterds, but, yeah, I mean, there were people fighting for themselves, you know.
Right.
And is that, you know, that's emotionally correct, even if it's in this device of, you know, Brad Pitt and
yeah,
whatever. And so I was thinking about the poems, and is it that they become sort of emotionally correct for you?
That definitely feels right to me. That's how I think I go about it.
Yeah.
Is making it as emotionally truthful or honest as I can make it.
Yeah. Yeah. And in that, I think, again, going back to those cave paintings on the hand, like a true meaning and dignity of, I don't know, the human experience, you know, right? Is,
yes.
I think, what is really, again, what I love about the poems. And I think the other dimension that really sticks out for me is your sense of place and the role Pittsburgh plays in these. And I will say, I'm also a transplant. Uh-huh. You know, so I came to hear from a different place with a different sensibility even.
Yeah.
You know, and you're from Detroit.
Yep.
And so when did you move to Pittsburgh?
I moved to Pittsburgh in 2000.
So. Me too.
Oh, yeah.
Me too. June of 2000.
Okay. Yeah, I think I was July. It was definitely summertime.
June, July, summer of 2000. Yep. Yeah. Yep. You probably get that good apartment in Shadyside I was looking at or something. No. Well, yeah, I had a good friend at the time who was a little racist. And okay. So convinced me that if I didn't live in Shadyside or Squirrel Hill, I would die.
Oh, like, boy.
Basically, yeah. And so what happened? I lived in a hotel until October.
Really?
Yes. Because I just knew this is these two neighbors. Anything else that Jim said? And the guy was full of shit, you know? I mean, there is, you know. That's the other thing, too, is, you know, there's shitty old Pittsburgh. I mean, so we could talk about this experience, too. The way Pittsburgh has changed
in the last 16 years yeah.
is amazing.
It is. We witnessed it.
We did. We lived it. And so I think about you, too. And, you know, there's that thing, you know, Robert Hughes, the art critic, he was from Australia, but he specialized in American art. And he said, like, it actually, I'm more qualified as an Australian.
Yeah,
because I can see it totally as an outsider, and I don't, you know,
right.
thing.
Yep.
And not that there's not some great Pittsburgh poets and great Pittsburghers who understand this place, but right. I think for me, it also there's an element of. I think even though still, I mean, I've spent most of my adult life, actually, all but 3 years of my adult life, five years of my adult life as a resident of Pittsburgh. Only 2 years of my post-college life not living here.
Yeah.
There still is a novelty to it.
Yeah.
You know, and I love how your poems kind of capture that.
Cool. Yeah. Place is definitely important to me. Pittsburgh's important to me. And it definitely gets into the poems. It was kind of like I didn't necessarily expect to stay here when I moved here, but I like it so much that not only did I stay, but I love writing about it.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about even some of the poems in River Underneath the City, like One Night at Duke's.
Yeah.
Dale's is the place in Greenfield. Yeah, I was thinking Duke's. Which one was Duke's? Where was Duke's?
It's it was like across from where there's this Pep Boys now in North Oakland.
Shadyside. Okay. Yes, okay.
So now there's like two different burrito shops and
there's a sub shop there. Oh yeah. Which I guess that's the thing is you hit on it, right? Is I mean, well, East Liberty's gone. Right. East Liberty's gone.
Yeah.
We did a podcast about that. I don't know if you know Robin Clark.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, we did a podcast on the East Liberty situation. Okay. And it's gone.
Yes.
I think Garfield is lined up next.
You know. That's where I live now.
Okay. So, it's great. See, I love Garfield, but it's like, no, it's happening here. It's changing. No.
Yep.
No. I mean, there's part of me, you know, I watch those Rick Seebeck documentaries. And you see, like, footage of, like, 90s downtown Pittsburgh when, like, none of the streets were paved.
Right. Nobody's like, walking around.
Nobody's walking around. I miss that.
Uh-huh.
I know it's a weird thing to say, but there are bumper stickers around, and if I was a bumper sticker person, I'd put one on one of my cars. Keep Pittsburgh shitty.
I've seen that, yeah.
You know?
Uh-huh.
But I think there was just something about, there's something about this place that, and I think you're especially the poems in River Underneath the City,
yeah,
kind of capture this, of Pittsburgh as being this kind of world apart, and being really in touch with. You know, I mean, I think the Pittsburgh fall down was so dramatic. I guess sort of like Detroit's.
Yeah.
But with Detroit, the buildings are kind of gone. Whereas in Pittsburgh, there's still these little places where you can say, aha, that, you know, that looks probably the same. That hasn't been redone since the 70s, you right. know?
Yeah.
And I love that. You know, there's the time machine quality to this city.
Definitely. Yeah, no, that's one thing. It's like capturing the stuff that's still there while it's still there, you know? I think that's probably something CPAC aims for, is to try and
Yeah, which actually is, I mean, if we could do it, can we go to the Floating Theater on page 45 of River Underneath the City, available on Logos Press. It's Logos number 4, part of a series. Yes.
Sure, yeah. The Floating Theater. Tonight it is the roof at Graham Street and Decision. The sun slipping down and nothing doing but contrails of planes overhead, occasional birds and paper alleys. Soon it'll be cathedral lights, an orange hospital glow if I can see that far, or if I could see even further out, maybe those small domes over on Observatory Hill. This morning the house was quiet except for piano music on the hi-fi, an infrequent tapping on the typewriter, or the noise of strays in the sun out on the back deck. Summer already and hot, but we keep the house cool with curtains drawn and Westinghouse fans blowing. All across the city, people are saying different things. The guy in the corner drawls, a little bit of hell. My mother, talking about football players, says, all of my heroes are just made of sand. A man with a low voice bleeds through my stereo saying, black Kojak. I put on a record at the bookshop, and my boss says, cookin'. A woman working the Penny and Dairy comes back from the cooler, and she says, I just seen the illest shit in America. Through all of the rain-streaked windows of buses, you can see the Pittsburgh that used to be, and also the Pittsburgh that is. Somehow they're coexisting. Sonny Clark still plays piano up in the Hill District. Johnny Unitas is still quarterbacking in Bloomfield, on fields made out of dirt and factory soot, I'm sure. True, third base of Forbes Field has been relegated to a bathroom stall and a men's room in Posfar Hall. But Gertrude Stein frequents a bench by the aviary on occasion, just down from Gus the ice ball man. Pittsburgh is the kind of place where it is not very difficult to fall in love, mostly because it is so easy to fall for the city itself, the landscape or feeling. There is an architecture of being in a certain place. Here in Pittsburgh, we are all the Floating Theater.
Some damn fine poetry.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Oh, no, wow. I mean, that's right, Gus the Ice Ball Man. Mm-hmm. I mean, Gus the Ice Ball Man on the north side is one of these pieces.
Yeah.
And, yeah, no, it's amazing for me. I mean, Pittsburgh, many, many years ago, well, not that many years ago, but some time ago, now that I'm getting older, everything is a long time ago. This band Marat that I like, and they're performing at the Kolar Club on the south side.
Okay.
Which is an old Slovak ethnic heritage club.
Yeah.
And the lead singer, Dave Belanco, says, you know, Pittsburgh is the one place in America that hasn't figured out it's America yet. And you should keep it that way. And I was like, oh, he likes Pittsburgh. Yay! This guy whose record I like likes Pittsburgh. Yay! He's like, don't fuck it up, people. Don't fuck it up. Don't turn Pittsburgh into America. And I was like, yeah, he likes it. And then I started to travel. I was traveling. Like, the next time I went somewhere, you know, my mom moved from New Jersey to a gated golf community in South Carolina.
Okay.
And I keep, now I think about whenever I go somewhere, I'm like, oh, I'm in America. That's right. That's right. This is so different and weird and empty, and everything looks like it came from a Big Lots. You know what I mean? I was,
yeah.
Is this what America is? Or, you know, I did some driving around the summer and the same thing. I was like, oh yeah. This is America. And I realize now almost, too, I can't function outside of Pittsburgh.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's really weird. Like, I can handle, like, Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And, like, a city. Like, if I'm in a city, I can handle that. But anything else or any city that's not Pittsburgh, even sometimes, I'm just like,
you don't know what to do with
yourself. I needed an adult, and I sold myself. You know what I mean? It's like that same, like, I just dysfunction, and and I guess for you, you know, the poem, like that poem for me, The Floating Theater, just really captures for me the tension of this place right now, as it's, you know, there's now this announcement that the building that Rosebud and Metropool was in might be sold, and
oh, yeah.
The developer wants to turn the Strip District into a tourist attraction.
Oh, yeah.
As if.
It's not touristy.
As if it's not touristy enough. And one of my friends actually posted, you know, because the mayor posted. It's like, yay, more development. And he's like, and he was like, wait till the first Panera Bread goes in.
Ah.
You know, Panera Bread's America.
Right.
The Strip District, and Maurice Kilwan Guevara has got this great poem about the Strip District called When the Light Turns Red.
Oh, yeah?
And it's just, you know, what you see in a day in the Strip District. And I remember once handing that a handout of that to my students, and they're like, oh, this is what poems can be. Capturing, encapsulating an experience and distorting the language or using line break enough.
Yeah.
That the meaning of that experience gets brought in a more vivid way.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah. And they're like, that was a really good class that semester. Because I was like, all right, we're going to do the poetry unit. And everybody groaned. And I handed that one out. And they were like, oh, now I get it. And I was like, yes. But, I mean, the tension. I mean, do you find yourself now, like, still able to perceive Pittsburgh with this sort of, like, new lens or this outsider lens, or is there still a novelty to it? And does that help with, in terms of thinking about, oh, this is going to become a poem or this idea or this experience?
I think I still have it. Yeah. I think I still have a kind of an outsider's, perspective, outsider's view. But I mean, I've been here long enough that I also know the city some, you know? So, Yeah, I think it gives me a kind of perspective about what to appreciate, what we have here.
Yeah, and so for you, what is, you say about falling in love with Pittsburgh? And I mean, we see it in this poem, but what is it that you love about this place? And what is it that is sort of poem-worthy about the place, you know?
Yeah, there's
sort of walk through this great poem. You
know. Yeah, no, there's just, there's a lot to love about Pittsburgh, I think. One thing is just the rich history that, you know, it just, it feels like there's endless things to write about, you know. I can write about my own life, but I can write about things that have happened, you know, on the streets that I walk every day. So,
or are the things that have happened metaphors for your own life? Sorry, I am an English professor, people. I gotta play
that card. You're reading into it.
And then how far until you're clever, too clever, you know, teaching interpretation right now in Comp 1.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, well, okay, you got to stretch. Don't go too far, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, so there is the sense of history.
Yeah.
Because we're sitting in a 101-year-old house.
There we go.
There we go.
For example.
For example.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, I love the culture and all of its different manifestations around here. I love the sports culture. I love the, you know, the people of the city.
Yeah. And so you run the new Yinzer.
Yes.
Which maybe we should explain first to, because I do have a few people listening and aren't from Pittsburgh. What's a Yinzer? Then what's a new Yinzer?
Right. Okay. Yeah. So a Yinzer is just a Pittsburgher. Because in Pittsburgh, people say yins instead of you guys or you all.
Yeah, that's the problem with this language, right? There is no you plural.
Right.
We need a you plural. We need a universal you plural.
Right.
Philly, it's yous, which I hate everything Philadelphia. But yous makes a lot of sense. Just put an S on there. It's plural.
There you go.
Right? But right. Yins...
Yeah.
Or my mom from Johnstown, Ewens.
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 That's a good.
Or Yuns.
Yuns. Yuns.
So that's a Yinzer. So what's the new Yinzer?
So yeah, the new Yinzer is an online magazine that I took over with a couple of friends. And it's an online magazine. We do writing about local culture. We do writing about music. We do writing about books and literature. There's poems, there's short stories, there's all kinds of stuff. Photography. So yeah, it's an new Yinzer is an online
magazine. New Yinzer. So when do we go to the post Yinzer? You know what I mean? When to become so self aware Yinzer that we enter the post Yinzer
right,
phase? Maybe that's the thing I need to write. Maybe we'll write the essay about Pittsburgh gentrification. Are we going post Yinzer? Are we like still, you know, high rise condos, but they still wear Steelers jerseys to the Giant Eagle. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Is that post Yinzerdom? I don't know.
Yeah, but it's just in the next stage, the next step in the progression.
Next steps. Yeah, and so yeah, so Pittsburgh thing. So I will say I love this because we're going to get to now tension. We're going to now if we tension. Could go to
okay.
If we go to another poem that I really like from Unattended Flyer on page 61,
mm-hmm.
Against Nostalgia. Against Nostalgia. So we're talking about history. We're talking about life.
Yes.
But now let's complicate things. Let's throw a monkey wrench in the work and
okay.
Talk about a poem called Against Nostalgia.
Okay, you want me to read this one?
Please? I'm sorry, I'm a taskmaster.
No, that's fine.
And that's the thing, for this podcast, you brought the beer. I usually bring the beer. So I'm an inhuman monster, people. And I'm sorry, but hey, the podcast is free, so.
Yeah, no, I'm doing fine. I'm happy. I'm good. All right, Against Nostalgia. It's strange to think we can't go back, but not sad necessarily. If those days then were now, I wouldn't think so fondly of them. Time allows for the freedom of memory. I'm able to go back, if I like, to when I like, ignoring for a moment the couples walking the hill, driving past them, alone in my car, not sad, but free in a way.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. So what's for you? What's this poem about? You know, as we just talk about all these things. Oh, history, you know, we record things, you know. Because I think nostalgia is this very particular and very peculiar form of memory.
Right.
Teaching that too in Cop One.
Right.
Memory, yeah.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I think this is probably, I wrote this poem around when I found out the, like, etymology of the word nostalgia.
Mm.
Which, you know, not like I'm not like a person that's obsessed with words, but sometimes, you know, I'll find something.
Well, you have
like,
to be, though.
You're right.
It's part of the gig.
Yep. But sometimes, you know, you find something and you're like, wow, well, isn't that interesting?
So what is the etymology of the word nostalgia?
So
this is...
Yeah, so nostalgia, if you work it out, it's like pain at returning home, of sadness or a pain at returning home. So Gia,
wow.
I think... Let's see if I can remember it now, because it's been a while.
It's okay.
But Gia is, I think, pain or suffering. And
oh, wow.
And Nosta is to return home. So,
wow.
Yeah.
So the meaning of that word has kind of traveled.
Yes.
Wow. It's like literally. Yeah, you know, uh-huh. Yeah, we're now... It, probably at this point, literally means both literally and figuratively.
It doesn't mean
wow,
just literally.
I mean, you think nostalgia
mm-hmm.
is like it's a culture industry of its own now.
Right. It
you
is.
You know?
For
and,
sure.
And Gen X generational narcissism, as I lived under baby boomer generational narcissism, as I'm terrified of the possibilities of millennial generational narcissism. You know? It's funny because I said this in class the other day. We're talking about nostalgia.
Yeah.
And it's a way of thinking about and, you know, reading this wonderful, lovely, amazing novel. We're here to promote your books, but Tender by Belinda McKeon.
All right.
Is, wow. I liked it. Students, maybe not so much, but it's about my needs. You know?
Right.
And it's about this failed romance.
Uh-huh.
And then the last act of the novel, the couple meets 14 years later. And sort of the female protagonist of the novel, Catherine, did something very terrible to James, her object of love, who happens to also be gay. So it wasn't going to work, you know, and
yeah.
it's... you have this like Wile E. Coyote thing as this romance, and her feelings are evolving. You're like, no, this isn't it. And, you know, kind of thing happens. Much like a Wile E. Coyote cartoon, right? The fall is inevitable. Yeah. And what a fall it is, you know?
Yeah.
And then 14 years later, he initiates contact again.
Okay.
And I said to them, you know, George F. Will, who is a brilliant guy, when he's not talking about politics, gender, history, or economics, baseball, he's on it.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, there was I remember this as a kid. It was one of those moments that has stuck with me.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, changing the filter of how I saw the world. It was Bob Dole's convention speech in 96.
Okay.
Which was about World War II.
Uh-huh.
He did this whole long convention speech about his World War II experience.
All right.
And how the 96 election... vote for me and win World War II or something, or reclaim World War II or whatever it was. And I remember David Brinkley, they cut away, and it was ABC News, and it was either David Brinkley or Sam Donaldson.
Uh-huh.
It was around the table, and George F. Will was one of the people at the desk. And
okay.
And it's like, well, what do you think? And George F. Will said, well, there's always a market for creative nostalgia. And that moment for me defined nostalgia as a concept. And so when I saw that poem, I was like, yeah, move on, motherfuckers. But that's such an interesting thing, because I always thought of nostalgia as this filtering.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I love that line about, was it, I wouldn't think kindly of those times. What was that line? I lost my page.
Uh-oh, it's place. 61.
61.
Yeah.
Beer might have gone to my head, folks.
Uh-oh.
Good thing I'm not driving. You know, yeah, I wouldn't think so fondly. If those days were now, I wouldn't think so fondly of them. I'm slurring my speech. This is bad. Not going to have two. Yeah, and I was like, yeah, fuck yeah, man. Fuck the past, man. Move on. But, I don't know. Catches me sometimes. As it catches us all.
Yeah.
And so I love that interesting tension of... you can have that feeling.
Yeah.
But almost sort of rationally, no. Nope.
Don't be sad.
Don't be sad about it. It's over.
Yep.
It's over. You know, Vin Scully even, you know, he
right.
paraphrased, and I guess it's not Dr. Seuss, but it, or at least according to Vin Scully. Last game was Sunday. He said, yeah. You know, don't be sad that it's over. Smile that it happened or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. And I think about that, you know, how do we make the way that language gives us this incredible tool to make meaning of experience.
Yeah.
And the poet and the writer's task.
Yeah.
As that.
Yeah.
Is interesting. And again, so I think it's what makes, for me anyway, these poems really compelling. Is how they do that. And so, let's see, what do I want to ask? You know, do you consider yourself, I guess, you know, well, actually, the other thing is, it's gone in my head, folks. So you're going on tour, right? This is
going
to help promote. So you're leaving on Saturday. So speaking of a sense of place.
Yep.
And there is definitely one more poem I want to get to, and we'll transition to it. Aha, I am thinking of something.
Uh-huh.
You know, so for you, is even like sort of going on the road, sort of poem fodder, or a way of thinking about, you know, you have these experiences that push you maybe out of your comfort zone. And is that also part of where the genesis of your poems go, or you just go, you know, this isn't the routine?
Yeah, I haven't, I know that, Jason Baldinger, who's going on the road with me, he does a lot of road poems and traveling poems, and I haven't done it as much, but I definitely feel that getting out of the comfort zone will definitely make for some creative fodder.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a lot of those poems in Unattended Fire where it seems like it was a weird night out. I mean, the poem actually, so it's we're in Park Place / Regent Square, and there's a talk of Milton Street and looking for a cassette on somebody's porch.
Yeah, an old poetry teacher, Tony Hoagland's porch that he left a tape of Larry Levis reading. So,
and you got the wrong porch.
I might have gotten the wrong porch. There was alcohol involved that night.
I remember that. So it's like almost too. I mean, that's the other thing too, is Pittsburgh can be weird, and not in that like. I hate that because there's that Portlandia kind of keep Portland where it's not that. This is still hopefully kind of a no-nonsense, no-bullshit city. I still, that's the other thing I love about it. But weird stuff happens. If you go out enough, weird shit happens in this town. And yes, alcohol is a nice lubricant for that. But I was thinking about a
lubricate the weird.
Yeah, lubricate the weird. You know, sometimes it's got to come out, you know? And the hole is very tiny sometimes. I just said that. Wow. But I think about that, too, is, you know, a lot of these, a lot of the poems in Unattended Fire for me capture that, you know.
Yeah.
Well, and weird shit happens.
Yep.
You know, which is a thing. But what I want to talk about, though, I'd be remiss before this is all over. I think the meta poem for me on page 40 of Underneath the City, Hikmet?
Oh, yeah. Hikmet.
I mean, which for me, maybe, like, so I read them in reverse order. River Underneath the City first.
Uh-huh.
And then Unattended Fire. But still, this is the one that was like, oh. This is the Rosetta Stone for the Scott Silsby canon, maybe.
All right, I'll give it a read here.
Yeah.
Hikmet. Tonight I am thinking about Hikmet. Over 40 years old, a poet in prison for writing poems, measuring the paces of his cell. And here I sit trying to write a good poem. It could be that good poems are only written out of darkness and despair. But Hikmet said, living is no laughing matter, and live with great seriousness, and live as if you will never die. I don't need an Ars Poetica to say that I write to remember. Remind myself of the little things that happen here and there. Sometimes I curse myself for not writing more, but then I tell myself that I am just working on material by living. My copy of Hikmet has burnt fly leaves and page edges, which leads me to believe it was rescued from a fire. Some of Hikmet's poems traveled from a prison in Turkey, through fire, to multiple bookstores, no doubt, to my desk.
I like that. And I love that line. Sometimes I curse myself for not writing more, but then I tell myself that I'm just working out material by living.
Uh-huh.
You know? And I think about so many creative people I know who just are totally fucked up.
Yeah.
Because the message, I think, a lot of times is if you want to be a creative person or an intellectual person, you know, certainly grad school and whether it's, you know, an English program or the art school critique or the MFA program critique or whatever, you know, the message is you're not good enough.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's a huge message in our culture for creative people,
uh-huh,
is you're just not fucking good enough. And I love how this poem resolves that tension because, you know, So, this question, good poems are only written out of darkness and despair. Like, what do you do with that? In terms of your own thinking about, well, where do the good poems come from?
Uh-huh.
In terms of things you write, but also if we want to talk about things that you like to read.
I think I intentionally made it like a could be. Yeah. It's not like a for sure.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the idea is just that, some of the darker things that happen or, you know, that, are part of a person can result in.
Yeah, it helps. I mean, you think, I mean, always like realism is always usually assumed as something bad. Like realism is always like just, you know, the worst thing, you know, it's not even, well, I mean, I guess Theodore Dreiser novels are naturalism, which is like even the worst thing, you know.
Right.
I had a grad school professor who said, you know, what is realism? Realism is child is walking down the street with a lollipop. and it falls out of her mouth and drops on the sidewalk and lands in, you know, a hair or something.
Uh-huh.
Naturalism is it lands in dog shit. You know what I mean? Like, that's real. You know, that's what's real. That's how you know what the reality is.
Uh-huh.
But I think that's so interesting then, you know, the resolution of that then, you know, because we do have that expectation. There's that great, even Chimamanda Adichie, TED Talk, where she's like, you know, all writers are supposed to have terrible childhoods. And uh-huh. So she's like, when I learned that, I tried to figure out what terrible things did my parents do to me. You know what I mean? Or try to come up with some terrible things that my parents did to me or whatever, and it doesn't work.
Right.
And I think about that, and I think about that tension, you know?
Yeah.
You know, you gotta find the real or whatever.
Yeah.
Which could also, without anything else, can be kind of boring or trite or whatever. And so, I mean, to think that there's poems that are humorous. Steubenville, Ohio, for me, is another yeah. one in Unattended Fire. Uh-huh. Mostly because Steubenville, Ohio is probably the worst place I've ever been. You know? And I've been lost in Chester, Pennsylvania. You know, that's a place. Yeah, you know, that there's a humor to that. And I think that's lovely, too. And to also think about, well, yeah, if you're not, you know, if you're not a political prisoner, what the fuck are you doing?
Right.
You know? You know what I mean? Like,
what do your poems have to say?
Yeah. And I love that, you know, again, it goes back to that handprint on the wall in the cave painting, I was here, I am somebody, you know,
yep.
thing, which is... It's refreshing, you know, it's such a human thing, but also I think our culture is so inhumane, it's so refreshing. So to hear the line, you know, I tell myself that I'm working on material by living. Yep. I'm just working on material by living is, that's inspiring people. It should be inspiring. Whatever the hell that you're doing out there that you want to do, or the thing that you're supposed to do,
yep.
you should do it.
Yeah,
and realize that maybe in a certain way you're doing it now,
mm-hmm.
and maybe other people might not see the worth in that, but fuck them. Am I right?
You're right.
I mean, do it. I mean, I guess for you, then this is another question. This is the thing I struggle with in my writing.
Mm-hmm.
So for you, was there a moment? Was there a time? And this even goes back to the last podcast we had. My friend Adam was on, and he's a painter.
Okay.
And but he's like, I don't have a website yet, because then if I have a website, that means I'm a painter.
Ah.
And I was sort of like, no, dude, you're a painter. you've done it. You're there. You're, you know.
Yeah.
For you, where was the moment that you were like, no, I'm a poet? You know what I mean? Because there's this way, because I've also known those friends as sort of like, you know, they wrote, but now they don't write anymore. They just right. kind of turn it off, or they don't believe in it, or that, you know, it's like these secret notebooks or whatever.
Right.
For you, was there a moment where you're like, no, fuck it. This is real, man. This is real, and the world's going to have to deal with it, and fuck it. You know? Like, yeah. Was there a moment for you as in your sort of creative development?
I think there've probably been a couple of big moments. I think one was definitely like when I was an undergrad and studying under a teacher, John Rybicki, that I really admired. And, you know, like, first few things I gave him, he was just like, yeah, you know, like, you're getting there. But, like, and it was, like, the first thing that I wrote for him that he was just like, now this is, you did it. You know, like,
yeah.
The first piece that he was like, this is it. You know, it's a breakthrough piece for you, like... Once, like, I had, you know, basically his blessing, like, I felt...
So, in a weird way, it's like, you're doing that now with the new Yinza, right? You can give people that valid, like, that,
yep.
Nope, you're real.
Uh-huh.
So, what else was there? What other big moments were there for you as a creative person that you were like, nope, this is valid? You know, other people should... I mean, there's a weird way. It's like, you know, because what you write is very personal and very thing, but then yep. it's like, suddenly you go, nope. Other motherfuckers should pay attention to this right now. You
yeah.
know, kind of thing. Like, how do you get to that?
Right.
You know,
right.
Advice for the youth.
Yeah.
Or the middle-aged who lost the thread and the ember is still burning with them deep inside of their creative machine.
Uh-huh.
Let's yep. get that thing kicking again.
Yep. Well, yeah, I guess for me it's funny because writing's so personal, you know, solitary, like, it you have to like force yourself into a room without anybody else to like get anywhere with
Which is how against the contemporary world is that?
Right.
You know? Damn.
Yep. But then for me, one of the most rewarding things is like sharing it like in a reading or, you know, in book form or sending it out to magazines and, you know, getting that kind of like validation in one way or another. And so, I mean, another big moment for me was the Unattended Fire like book launch. You know, I had my friends reading with me, but like, you know, it was really just a great reading, great night. Like everything was so positive. And it was just like, This feels right, you know? This feels like what I wanted.
Yeah. Yeah, and it didn't turn horrible. So there you go, right? I mean, that's always, you know, yeah. I remember that, though. I do remember I had a music teacher in college who once said, it actually wasn't to me, it was somebody else. They were having problems with, they were a composer, award-winning composer even.
Uh-huh.
And then suddenly there was some bullshit that then came with being somebody. Uh-huh. And she said, don't ever try to turn your job, your hobby into a job. And I was like, oh, mixed message. Oh, I don't know what to do with this.
Uh-huh.
20 years later, still don't know what to do with that knowledge. So it's nice that, yes, you don't have to be a political prisoner and stuff like that. And again, finding worth and meaning in a place. And just singular individual experiences, interesting nights out.
Yep.
Thoughts that I think seem to what drift through your mind. You know, you're just,
yep.
I looked out that window and there is something.
Yep.
It's really cool.
And I'm going to keep track of it.
Yeah.
That thing I saw.
That thing you saw, right. And so I asked, here's another question then. From first idea to this is a real poem.
Mm-hmm.
About how long is that process? Because I think, you know, the two extremes, the world is just overpolluted, you know, the Allen Ginsberg, first thought, best thought, which was bullshit. You can buy the original manuscript of Howl and see all the changes. It was self-mystification, people. Don't take it seriously. I know as, you know, for my generation, that was a whole generation of writers that were just ruined. But no, man, I'm not revising, man.
I
wrote
Ginsberg,
it.
Man.
Yeah, and I just like, smack those people in the face. I got the honor and privilege of meeting Donald Hall once.
Oh, yeah? Nice.
For him, he said it takes a year.
Oh, yeah.
A year. And from initial thought to I'm ready to show this to people. But he, interestingly enough, his readers' copies of when he goes out and reads, even stuff that's been anthologized,
yeah,
he still has annotations in them. He's still fucking with the poems he wrote, you know, in the 60s.
Uh-huh.
And, which I think is interesting. But, of course, for him also, I mean, it was 6-7 years after Jane Kenyon died.
Yeah.
And you would think it was a couple months ago when he was talking about her.
Yeah.
It was like, wow.
Yeah.
That's holding on. Yeah. Oh, that's not healthy, dude.
That's intense. Yeah.
That's also other interesting Donald Hall story.
Yes.
Doesn't wash his hands after he pees.
Well, that is interesting to know about.
Sorry. I had that experience. I was in a men's room with Donald Hall. And yeah.
Maybe Doc Ellis time. Doc Ellis is like, I pee before I go to the bathroom.
Yeah, no. Yeah, no, didn't wash his hands.
Huh.
And that was at, you know what, that was at dinner. I'm now thinking, was there like a community bread basket? Because that changes everything.
Oh, shit.
But so for you, what is the nuts and bolts of the process? Again, for the youth.
for the youth. Yes. Yeah, I think things take, you know, they vary. It varies how long things take. But, yeah, you know, it starts with a note and it, develops slowly into a poem and, it could take a month or it could take a couple years.
Oh, really? So yeah. You have a poem's a couple years.
Yeah. I mean, I just have all of these like notes upon notes of stuff to write and sometimes it's just the right time.
I get you. So are there sort of problem children poems still waiting to be born?
Oh,
I've been there. Like, that experience was so meaningful. So meaningful, I can't get it all in yet. Right. I mean, is that a thing? So
it's a thing, yeah. There are drafts just kicking around that have been kicking around for years.
That's good. No, I mean, I think we have a culture that's very much, you know, there's one way that poetry exists in the world in 2016, in that it is the perfect art, literary art medium in some ways for our lives. That, you know, like I say about me, I usually read poetry books like boxes of chocolate. You know, I just grab one and go, I need something right now.
Uh-huh.
Not this one, not this one. Ah. You know.
Uh-huh.
You know, The Natural History of Death by Paul Zweig is upstairs in the attic. You know, I can go get that one when I need it. You know, and it's just perfect. And I'm in for 10 minutes and I'm out. You know, and it's great.
Yeah.
So it exists in that form, but then I guess this way of thinking about time,
yep,
and that we're only racing ourselves, maybe.
Right. Yeah. I love how, like, it feels like poetry can make time stand still, like, both in, like, the moment that you're capturing in the poem, but also that, like, when you pick the book up, like, the outside world is gone, you know,
yeah,
while you're reading that poem, like, because you're just in that poem, like.
Yeah, and I know even for my students, like, some of their resistance to poetry is that, you know, that they have to, you have to think your way in sometimes.
Yep.
And you get this whole, like, skewed, alternate, but rich, complete sense of reality. You know,
yep.
Again, to go back to the poem about the Pittsburgh Floating Theater, you know, for me, it's just like, wow, that's a city in a poem.
Uh-huh.
You know, whereas, yeah, you know, the Steubenville, Ohio one, you know, is, again, it's like a snapshot.
Right.
And yep, it's so good, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So on that happy note, we're doing good on time. So, all right. So you have on Logos Press, The River Underneath the City.
That's
there'll
right.
be links on the thing.
Yep.
Unattended Fire on Six Gallery Press. Again, there'll be a link on the podcast. You have something yep. in the pipeline? Something waiting to be born? You want to talk about that briefly? And actually, if you want to read maybe something from there, since you get to choose the poem this time. It's my podcast. And I'm drinking your beer. But it's my podcast. But I'll let you. I'll let you maybe close this out on a reading. We'll talk more promotion, but, actually, if you want to look for, as what I'm talking about, so you're going on tour starting Saturday, you're going to do the Midwest.
That's right.
I guess there are Facebook events.
Yes. Yeah, they're lining up. Yep.
They're lining up. Great. What cities are you going to?
We're doing Columbus, Ohio, Indianapolis. There might be a Kalamazoo, but I don't think so. Chicago.
Nice.
Lawrence, Kansas.
Oh, that's right. You're going...
We're going out to see Jameson Bales in Lawrence, and he set one up in Lawrence and one up in, Kansas City.
Nice.
So, and then we might try and do a reading at, like, William S. Burroughs' grave in St. Louis on the way home.
Fantastic.
So.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
All right, so what do you have for us?
Okay, so, I've been working on a new book called Muskrat Friday Dinner, and I think that it should be out next year in 2017. So I'm going to read a poem from that.
Great!
This is called What a Sad Christmas. Christopher's bar is all full up, and liquor world is closed already. So I wander down the avenue looking for some place to take me in, clutching a Brodigan in my coat in case I need some conversation. I used to keep a plastic cooler in the back of my beat-up old Volvo. Sometimes I'd put a case of beer on ice in there, sometimes a sixer and a nice bottle of bourbon. I like my bourbon with one lone rock. But I don't have the Volvo anymore. Traded it for a book of poems and watched it ride off down the highway to the city of lost angels. I know it's just the city of angels, but that's not how I think of it. What does it matter? It doesn't. I do get down like this sometimes, only to remind myself how good I have it. I have my failing health, I have a little bit of money, I have the love of a woman on occasion. One night in Kalamazoo, I was just cruising and I stopped to knock on the door of a girl I knew through a writing class at the university. She used to write these fun stories about doing drugs at dance clubs. When she opened her door, I said, "Let's go drinking and driving." And she laughed and said, "All right." We wound up at this Valentine diner up on M140, just outside of South Haven, called Ma's Coffee Pot. We didn't end up doing any drinking, just had coffee and pie and talked a while. She was a good talker, and she had a nice laugh. She made me feel less lonely, even on the dark and quiet ride home.
Wow. Wow. Fantastic. Fan-freaking-tastic.
Thanks.
And now it's time for the bottom five.
All right.
Are you ready? Bottom five, a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready, Scott?
I'm ready.
All right. Question one. This is the stock question. Everybody gets it. If reincarnation is real and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease or illness would you be?
Ooh.
Like, if you, like, it's totally fucked up, and you got to go back to single cell, you know, that sort of cosmology. Going back to single cell, mm-hmm. your disease, what would you want to be?
Ooh. I guess Zika, because it's so popular right now. I want to spread like that. I want to be that popular.
Oh, nice.
Get to ride around in mosquitoes.
Yeah. They're around the world and sexually transmitted too. So
right. That's fun.
There you go. I mean, you were the story of the Olympics.
Right.
Love it.
Big
All
news.
Right.
Big news.
Oh, question two, which is not a question. We've already violated the rules.
Okay.
It's not a question. It's a prompt.
Okay.
And this, who knows, maybe you can answer this in a poem. I don't know. Tell me a happy but somewhat unremarkable memory of your childhood.
Okay.
And this, so what I mean by that is not like, oh, we went to Disney World and it was the best thing ever. But like, no, it rained and we made cookies. That's what I mean by unremarkable. Happy but unremarkable.
Right. Okay. Yeah, this pops up. It's just kind of a random moment. But riding my big wheel down the street.
Okay.
And that Alan Parsons Project song, Eye in the Sky, was really popular at the time. And riding my big wheel and seeing an airplane over me and, like, singing that song. But I might have transposed the lyrics. I think it was, like, I'm high in the sky and I'm looking at you. I was thinking, like, the Alan Parsons Project, like, they were singing that song about me. Like, they were looking at me. High in the sky, looking at you. But it's just, a good, like, childhood memory. Just riding the big wheel. Having that, seeing that plane and having that song in my head.
Nice. Alan Parsons Project, yeah. Big wheels were the best.
Yeah.
Big wheels were awesome. I mean, the way you could drift those things and slide them off.
Yeah.
Oh, wear out those hard plastic tires.
That's right.
Damn.
To the bald.
Yes. Until they get holes in them. Damn, you slide too much. I
mean, and then you get rocks in the holes, and then rocks go around.
Yeah, and then it's over, and you're like... And then by then you're too old for a big wheel, so you're like, ask for another one, but you really never get the big wheel back, people. All right, question three.
All right.
Question three is the Christopher Hitchens question.
All right.
Because upon finding he had terminal cancer, he was like, he said, but I really wanted to read these people's obituaries. Wait, I wanted to write them. So, of the living villains of history, whose obituary would you like to write?
Villains of history.
Living villain of history.
Living.
Actually, somebody's still with us.
Yeah.
So the obituary is yet unwritten unless it's in some like CNN.com.
Yeah.
Unlinked webpage just waiting to go live when they kick it.
How about Cheney?
That's a solid choice.
I think that'd be a fun one.
That would be a fun one. The man with the reverse Midas touch. Everything he touched absolutely turned to shit.
Yes.
That was amazing about him. He just, grantedly, whatever the situation was, he fucked it up.
He figured out a way.
Yeah.
That's reverse amazing. Midas touch.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's like, is this this tale of, like, you know, because then I would think, God, if you wrote Cheney's obituary, would you find some humanity in the man? Like, what if he suddenly becomes this tragic, you know, what if he really is Midas son? I can't go to the bathroom because my dick will turn to gold.
You know, kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
All right. Question four. You live in a world of books.
Yes.
Yes. So let's just say, hypothetically,
all
right, we're living in a dystopian future, right? There's some shit went down. It's bad.
Yes.
Just, you know, kind of open flames everywhere, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And the only books to survive would be those bound in human skin. Like, whatever, there's like, we're getting rid of all the books.
Yeah.
Except the ones bound in human skin. Don't ask me the logistics of this dystopian world. Just go with it, all right?
All right.
Would you make the choice, like, I need to sacrifice my skin for this, or else future generations, it's gone forever? Would you, and what book would you donate your skin for? And the Bible, Quran, and complete works of Shakespeare are already taken. Those are two the safe choices. Somebody's on those, people. Somebody did the Quran, Bible, works of Shakespeare.
Yeah.
They exist, okay?
Uh-huh.
But in this dystopian nightmare escape, would you say, oh, well, this book is worth sacrificing my being for so that future generations of human history... Because if I don't do it...
Nobody else is going to do it.
Yeah. No one else is going to read this book, ever.
I think that I'd probably donate my skin to... The Great Fires by Jack Gilbert.
Ooh.
You know him? He's from Pittsburgh.
Yeah, the name's familiar. I have not read... I should probably read that book then, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
And so should everybody else. But you should read Unattended Fire and River Underneath the City first.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And then move on.
Yeah.
There you go.
Those might be my two and three after I donate. If I have enough skin.
If you have enough skin, yeah. Yeah. All right. So actually, you know, I'm gonna switch this up. I had an idea. I had a fifth one planned, but question five.
Yeah.
If you could unmake any invention, what would it be?
Ooh.
Speaking of taking things in and out of reality or keeping things in reality, is there something that you would, if you could, take it out of? You know, if you could unmake that invention, go back in time, you know, shoot that person in the head or, you know... Whatever.
All right.
Distract their parents on that night, and so they're never conceived, never born, the thing is never made. I don't know how you would do it. Again, just go with the premise. If you could take an invention out of our reality, what would it be?
That's a good question. I'm going to go with the internet.
Really? That's a bold one. I like it. Why the internet?
Well, I mean, it's great for so many things, but it's also so distracting. And I can remember a time without it in my life, you know.
Me too.
And you know, my life is better in some ways because of it. Like, this tour was pretty easy to put together.
And promote and
all of that.
We're on a podcast that will be on the internet.
On the internet?
Yes. But,
life was so different without it.
Wasn't it?
Yes.
The hours of nothingness.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't that great.
Uh-huh.
You know, Douglas Copeland has that art piece. It's just, you know, he had those placards of, like, sayings for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, multicolored, like, fluorescent-colored placards. And just bold Helvetica, big font, all caps, these sayings. And one of them was, I miss my pre-internet brain.
There you go, yeah.
Which, I think about what we were saying a moment ago, though, about poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And the time stopping.
Yep. Yeah.
And what does that say for maybe the mind of the poet, right?
Yeah.
To get rid of that immediacy.
Yep.
And you just maybe have either singular time or eternity. I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah. Well, it just feels like the internet has sped everything up. Everything's faster because of it, and everything's becoming faster. because of it too, you know? So I don't like that.
No, it's weird. I mean, the immediacy of mm-hmm. everything. Again, I just remember waking up, and maybe it was also because I was a college student. I didn't have a job. I didn't have responsibilities. You know,
yeah.
I made the rent on the 5th of the month. We're good. You know, right. We're good for another 29 days, man. Yeah.
No responsibilities.
Remember that bastard February. I mean, it was just basically feeding myself. That was it. You know, feeding myself.
Right.
basic hygiene, and we're good. But like actually waking up with those days of like, what am I gonna do today?
Uh-huh.
You know, time was just
yep
this luxurious overflowing thing, and you were just drowning in it, man.
So, yep, a lovely drowning.
Yeah, that's a title. Maybe I'll go to the video store or something, you know?
Right.
Because I'm with you. I'm still attached to physical objects.
Uh-huh.
You know, physical media. I have books. And I have a Kindle.
Uh-huh, right.
You know, I have a tablet I can read PDFs on, but that's even getting to be a bit much.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sense of time, that sense of, you know, also you think, again, thinking about writing, you know, I saw this, I was at this great panel at MLA some years ago.
Yeah.
And this person did grief narratives versus grief blogs.
Uh-huh.
And it was fascinating because they talked about how with narratives, you know, and they looked specifically at grief narratives, books from the 70s
uh-huh.
of that parents whose children died wrote.
Okay.
And then they looked at contemporary grief blogs of parents who had the same experience.
Huh.
And what's the difference? And
yeah.
the thing they said was the 70s, you know, you had narratology. You had the need to put things in symbolic order and to maybe even think of, you know, not just beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
But think about meaning.
Yeah.
Think about, well, what does the whole picture mean for the world?
Right. Reflection.
Reflection. He said, you know, the a good blog by nature or good status update or good tweet or whatever, it was about implotment. It's about some emotionally pregnant thing is happening right now and it's going to happen again next time I post. And the immediacy of it that you like, you can write something in 20 minutes and click send and it belongs to the world and you immediately yeah. get likes and feedback.
Yep.
And the person didn't make that leap. Because I think just, you know, the artistic form is like, you're not allowed to make that leap, but, or I'm sorry, the academic form, you're not allowed to make that leap. I was like, man, which one's healthier for a human being?
Yeah.
You know, to just live and think, well, this is what this all means, or this is how the events sequence, or whatever, or this is where I'm going.
Yeah.
Versus, dude, I can't even today.
And just spew it out.
And just spew it out or vague booking or any of that
right,
bullshit.
Right, right, right.
Is, you know what? I'm with you. I'm with you. Let's get rid of the internet.
I don't know where this podcast is going to go.
But. I know. Well, you know, well, from now on, we'll lathe cut on vinyl.
There we go.
You know.
Let's press this podcast.
Well, you know, that's the other thing about the internet. It's so temporal. You know, if you... I've said this on the podcast before. Sorry, regular listeners. Or sorry, Ren, regular listener. And Dave, other regular listener. If you submit an MP3
yeah.
to the Library of Congress,
uh-huh.
they lathe cut it into a piece of vinyl.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
That's how, because it's... Archivists are having this real worry. Because, you know, to keep... our internet history online, or to keep the internet online,
yeah.
it takes an incredible amount of maintenance.
Yeah.
And one of the things people who deal with old documents and old artifacts say, excuse me, is that things that you have to actively maintain usually don't fare very well.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know, I mean, even you think the Wild West of the early days of the internet, GeoCities is all gone.
Oh, yeah.
It's all gone.
Crazy.
You know, there's yeah. nobody's ever going to be able to do research or look at, well, how did people communicate in 1999? You know, so it's gone.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
But things that are passive, that you could put in a drawer. and just keep it dry. Or the case with the vinyl, stack it vertically, keep it away from heat.
Right?
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah, yeah.
MP3s, you need servers, you need maintenance, you need electricity, you need cooling,
yeah.
You need software upgrades, you need hardware, you know, to yeah. still work, and the digital things decay. And so there's people who are really thinking that actually, you know, we're going to have this incredible record of human history, especially since the photograph.
Uh-huh.
From about the 1820s till about 1990-something. And then it's just all going to go dark. And we're like, well, you don't know what happened. People didn't print that shit out.
Right.
They even said that in the Werner Herzog film, The Lo and Behold. There are people that have volunteered to print out Wikipedia.
Really?
If shit starts going down, there uh-huh. are people out there in the world that have promised that while if they still have electricity, they will print out Wikipedia and keep it somewhere. To try to preserve it from the elements, because that's it.
Ah.
Because then it'll just be gone. All that human knowledge.
Just gone. Lost. Yeah.
Yeah, so fuck the internet. Fuck the internet. Lathe Cut Podcast. You can get them at, you know, I'll get a P.O. box and, you know, $19.95 shipping per episode. But you'll get it. It'll be on vinyl. It'll sound great.
High fidelity.
High fidelity podcast from We're All Gonna Die. And on that happy note, I think that's about it. Again, so we will have on the website links to... where you can buy both the books direct from the publishers. We're also going to have a link to the new Yinzer.
Yep.
Maybe a couple other poems or whatever. Yep. You actually just posted a lovely one today called Don't Smoke in Bed.
There you go.
That'll be there and whatever else. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something. I don't know. I don't plan ahead. Our homepage... I also sometimes only do about 3 of these in a year. And so the fact that I did one 2 weeks ago, and here's another one, wow. Our homepage on the internet, where you can find new and old episodes, is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're also on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at gonnadiepodcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Thanks, Brett, as always, for the lovely theme music. Later, meets.